With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.
You're on Reality Check Radio. It's Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Have a listen to this. Oh, my goodness. Let me just read you this. The cost to 2050 of achieving net zero will comfortably exceed $550,000. $550,000. A workforce comparable in size to the health sector will be required for 30 years, including a doubling of the present number of electrical engineers, and will need about 10% of the global annual production of lithium, cobalt, neodymium, whatever that is, and other materials. Without a detailed roadmap, as exemplified by the International Technology Roadmap for Semiconductors that drove the electronics revolution since 1980, the target is simply unattainable. This from a report from Professor Michael Kelly, who joins us. Professor Kelly, good morning.
Good morning to you, sir.
I feel very honoured to have you on the show.
Well, thank you.
Because you're a very distinguished physicist, which I'd love to discuss with you first. Mm-hmm. And you've done sterling work looking at the physics and the technology of what is a legislated target in New Zealand. But first, mm-hmm. Professor Kelly, you're a Kiwi.
I'm indeed, come from New Plymouth.
Oh, well, that's a fine place.
I was educated by the Dalrymple brothers at Francis Douglas.
Well, they did a very good job.
Yeah, fine. I'm grateful. The best teacher I ever had in my life taught me maths and physics in the sixth and seventh form. I then went to Victoria University, and then in 1971 I went to Cambridge to do a PhD in solid-state physics.
And what year?
1971. Mm-hmm. I told my parents I'd be back in 1976, but didn't quite happen that way. And, in fact, I still live in Cambridge in England, where I've lived for 36 of the last 50 years.
My goodness. And for people that don't know, you've had a stellar career in physics.
Well, there's a lot of people like me, so I wouldn't put myself on a pedestal, but I have had some great fun, and I've been very fortunate in some of the things I've been able to do.
Now, what made you decide to become a physicist, and when did that happen? Was it that father teaching you back at high school?
No. Well, funny enough, my father was took me to meet a friend of his who worked at Ivan Watkins Dow, which had a chemical factory on the edge of New Plymouth. So when I left to go to Wellington, it was my interest was to do maths and chemistry. It was always going to be maths because I was strong at that. But within a term at university, the contrast between what I was taught in physics and what I was taught in chemistry was so big that I was hooked on physics straight away. And I did a combination of maths and physics all the way through up to master's level before going to Cambridge. Never looked back.
What was it that, what did you achieve that allowed you entry to Cambridge?
Well, I was very fortunate because another colleague, another New Zealander, 10 years older than me, and alas, dead for the last 2 years, had gone 10 years ahead of me and was now a professor at Cornell University, Neil Ashcroft by name. And he came back to have a sabbatical in New Zealand while he and a colleague were writing what became a major textbook in solid-state physics. And he supervised my master's thesis. So that when I got the scholarship to go to Cambridge, partly on his recommendation, I went to work with the person who had in turn supervised him 10 years older, a man called Volker Heiner.
Also and, a Kiwi.
Sorry?
Also a Kiwi.
Yeah, born in Germany during the end of the Weimar Republic and came out to New Zealand as a child, but went back to Cambridge in 1954. And indeed, 50 years to the day after I arrived in New Zealand, in the UK, namely the 25th of September in 2021, I took he and his wife out for lunch. And he, at that stage, he's 93 at the moment and still going strong. Well, so there's a strong New Zealand connection. So indeed. Then I was lucky. He had a number of problems, but he thought the one that he suggested for me was going to be the most interesting. And indeed, it proved to be. I was very fortunate.
Here's a question for you.
Yeah.
Scientists are working on solving problems and understanding things.
Yeah.
Can you, I imagine it's quite common that you spend a lot of time and actually never solve it.
Yes, in my master's thesis, I had two problems, one of which I solved, the other one which remains unsolved to the day. So, I mean, I tried all sorts of approximations, but it remains unsolved. So the art of doing good science is to actually pick a problem which you can see your way through. My own supervisor, Volker Heiner, again, he told me that he always gave a student a project to do which would take them the whole of their first year that he could do if he had 1 week of uninterrupted time with all his accumulated knowledge. He said it would take that long to learn all the peripheral material and to get to grips with the subject matter properly. But he did this because at the end of the first year, when you come back and say, well, now what we're going to do for the rest, his argument in many cases was to let the person carry on as they saw fit. That is, that he had enough. He only picked people who he felt had enough self-confidence to tackle problems. So when I went to see him and said, you asked me to do this, I've done that, what next? And he said, well, you seem to have plenty of good ideas, carry on. And at the end of my second year, beginning of my third, he suddenly got very interested in a piece of work I was doing. So we spent a whole of a Saturday morning and then carried on at a pub over lunch and mid-afternoon, going through this particular piece of work I was doing in great detail because he happened to be interested in it.
How and lovely. So
it was great. It was a wonderful form of supervision.
And, of course, you're working in the future, right? Because semiconductors have changed the world.
Yes. Well, that's certainly true. I mean, I'm part of it's interesting now. The hardware side, let me be careful. The hardware side is starting to slow down. The so-called Moore's Law, which predicts that computing power will carry on doubling every 2 years, that's starting to slow down now because in the days when I first built my Hewlett-Packard pocket calculator, every time a transistor switched on or off, about 100,000 electrons would go in and out. The transistors are so small now that you only need about 10 or 20 electrons to go in and out to switch one transistor. And so the extraordinary power of mainstream electronics since then has been this miniaturization. And this in turn leads to a great misunderstanding in more general terms. I would point out that the first jumbo jet flew in 1969, and if you put that jumbo jet next to one of today's jumbo jets, it's recognizably similar in scale. Whereas if you put a transistor of today next to a transistor of 50 years ago, it's thousands of times smaller. And so the progress of electronics, the rapid progress, was all about miniaturization, that is, putting more and more stuff into the same space and using fewer and fewer electrons to do the same job of switching from one to zero. Whereas in transport and energy in general, there's no such thing as a Moore's Law. But the common expectation is that the revolution of electronics should be able to be reproduced in the technology of other subjects. I mean, if aviation had gone as far as fast as electronics, we would get to New York in half an hour at Mach 5, and it just doesn't happen.
Tell us what a semiconductor is.
Well, the word semi is key because most things we know before mainstream semiconductors were either metals or insulators. either they conduct electricity or they don't. And a semiconductor is one that's sort of halfway between. If you induce it properly, you can make it into a conductor. If you bias it a different way, you can turn it into an insulator. So that's probably the best way of describing it. It's a material by which if you structure it and bias it, you can get it to switch on or off. You can't do that with metals or insulators.
And that's the key, because that replaces what we used to have in the old radios, the valve.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Because it's a switch that is amplifying a flow of electricity.
Yes, because the on state and the off state have either much higher resistance or low resistance. And so transistor is actually transferring resistance from low resistance to high or back again.
And, of course, it was a huge thing, the invention of the transistor. I think two Nobel Prizes. Was what, 1948?
Well, there's two kinds of transistors. And the first one to actually be made was in 1948. That's the bipolar transistor. The one that's far more common today, the field effect transistor, was patented in the 1920s but never made because of technological problems the 1960s.
No,
1950s, yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And when I was a kid, you would have like a 7-transistor radio, and the number of transistors was a big deal to how good your radio was. They tell me that when you look at an iPhone or a smartphone, it's got a lot more than 7 transistors equivalent in it.
It's hundreds of millions.
Yeah. Isn't that extraordinary?
It is.
And this was your field.
My field was the hardware. I have to say, I'm like a lot of people my age. I have a great deal of difficulty doing stuff on filling in forms online. So when I tried to tried to get the passenger locator form to get into New Zealand in Chile, I've come out via Chile this time. I spent 20 minutes trying to get access to the form, wasting my time. Then when I got to the front desk, they gave me a paper copy, which I filled in before takeoff. And it's that, I mean, I have a number of complaints. The Royal Society in London, of which I'm a fellow, has a new system for coping with refereeing papers. And it's supposed to have all the bells and whistles, but it's deeply inferior to the previous one in terms of person usage. So I happen to have a beef at the moment about the people who came after me writing the software.
Yes.
So,
and can you explain for us what you were working on, or some of the key things you worked on in relation to semiconductor?
Yes, up until the 1970s, nearly everything in semiconductors was based on a single material. And the two most common materials were silicon and gallium arsenide. These were bulk crystals. And the way you got them to work was to take dopants to make it more electron-like or more anti-electron-like in different regions of the same piece of semiconductor. But the big thing that happened during the 1970s became the ability to grow a crystal atomic layer at a time on top of an already piece. You take a piece of silicon, then you grow more and more layers on top of it. But as you grow them, you can change them. You can, in gallium arsenide, you can suddenly turn off the gallium and turn on aluminium and grow a thin layer of aluminium arsenide and then go back to gallium arsenide. You can do that at will. So instead of having a uniform piece of semiconductor, you have something that looks like a Viennese chocolate, dark chocolate, light chocolate. Dark, and that allows you to do all sorts of things when you look at the way transistors, lasers, and microwave devices, and I work mainly in the latter, microwave devices, to make them work better. So there was a period in the 80s when suddenly ordinary lasers suddenly became heterostructure lasers and quantum well lasers, all of which did things better than the ones beforehand. And that was a period where, again, Herb Kroemer, one of my mates, got the Nobel Prize for suggesting all this work in the late 50s, early 60s, although it took 20 years for it to come to fruition.
You must have some great friendships and colleagues all around the world.
All around the world, yeah.
It must be a great fraternity.
It is. It is. Except that over the last 20 years, I developed a stronger interest not so much in the physics of the semiconductors, but of the physics of the technology. So my main work in the last 20 years was something called manufacturability. 99% of what you see in the lab appears to be intrinsically unmanufacturable. What you keep doing is making one-offs and one-offs. But there's a very tight discipline required to be able to make the same thing inch by, centimeter by centimeter across a wafer and another wafer next door. There's a particular device associated with tunneling that the first time I made it with some friends, it had a very wide spread of about 300% of its electrical characteristics from one device to the next and from one wafer to the next, which was hopeless for manufacture. But over a period of 25 years working mainly with one colleague in Manchester, we got that number from 300% down to 1%. And there was a lot of very interesting physics in it. So I then developed, I lost contact with a lot of the people I worked with in the 70s and 80s, but in the 90s and 2010s, I worked with a smaller group, but interested. People at universities, for example, tend to think manufacturability is a problem for industry, which indeed it is. But behind it, the physics behind it was really quite interesting.
And then I'll leave it because I'm sorry. It's just so fascinating, your life. There is a thing I've heard from the United States politically that there's a concern that chips are basically made in Taiwan.
Yes.
And that you just can't magic up a factory to make chips.
No, and I think the geopolitics are such that there is an attempt now to onshore. I mean, it was partly also exacerbated by the COVID pandemic, which played havoc with supply chains. I mean, if you actually trace the contents of your mobile phone back to where the various components are made, they're all over the world, and bits fly from one continent to another and so on, and are put together. So, I was on the board of a company where our pieces were made in various parts of the world, but then shipped to China to be put into Apple's mobile phones and so on. So that was the disturbance to supply chains is such that there's now quite a lot of onshoring. So you're finding that some of the major American companies are bringing back to America, and partly pushed by strategic reasons. If China took over Taiwan tomorrow, it would cause a great deal of problems.
Yes. And, of course, you and your colleagues have done the work over decades, reaching back, well, from the 1920s, we learn, to make our world, really much make our world.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary.
Well, I think it is probably – this is why I referred in your opening statement, you made a note about the International Technology Roadmap of Semiconductors. This is a hugely important document. It started – because Gordon Moore in 1967 noted that in the first generations of integrated circuits he was making, there seemed to be twice as many transistors in each generation, and that he suggested in about 1971 that every 2 years the number of transistors on a chip would double. Well, that's not a physical law, but it was an observational law, and it kept going for 30 years. Now, by the 80s, when it had been going for a while, people started to realize the sheer complexity of the manufacturing techniques that would be required. And so what happened is it started out at the time when the Americans were concerned about the rapid rise of Japan semiconductor technology. So all the companies got together and formed a company basically, its role was to meet every 2 years with experts from all the companies and to work out a future map. So the assumption was that Gordon Moore's law would carry on forever, and this would be the start. And so behind that, you would say, well, if you want to make a transistor that's only 0.1 microns across in a certain year, then 3 years before that, you ought to have the manufacturing equipment ready to be beta tested. And then 5 years before that date, you should be able to do this, this, and this. And 10 years before the date, you should be able to do this. So this was a rolling program that got updated every 2 years, which looked out 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, and 20 years as to what was needed to keep this on. And it started out as an American venture, but eventually it became the world's technology roadmap for semiconductors. This is extremely important because everybody who worked in the semiconductor sector knew that everybody else was striving for the same goal. So you could wake up every morning and go into the office or the lab and know exactly which part of this technology roadmap you were working on, knowing that everybody else, everywhere else in the world, was working on the same technology. And in general, things went a bit faster than the roadmap because everybody was striving to compete with each other. This is something which, you know, if you say, well, electronics has changed the world in the last 30 years, I would say if we're going to have to change the world with respect to energy, we're going to need a roadmap of the same kind. And you'll suddenly find when you put that roadmap together that the sums are eye-watering and are just actually not going to happen. It's as simple as that.
Well, we've got your report, which is a shock, right? Because for years and years and years, New Zealand politicians have been talking about achieving net zero, and they've tried to outbid each other for who would do it quickest and who would do it best and who would do it fastest. To the best of my knowledge, no one has actually looked at how you would do it. And here you are with the Global Warming Policy Foundation. Having written a report that's entitled, and I suggest people get this report, and it's a very easy read. Thank you, Professor. Global Warming Policy Forum, and it's called Net Zero for New Zealand. And it's by Professor Michael Kelly. Now, tell us how you went about doing this report.
Well, I, like everybody else, took the line that climate change was serious and dangerous, et cetera, et cetera. But I spent three really exciting years running the second half of a very large program that linked Cambridge University to MIT. It was an extremely exciting project. But when it came to an end, I saw a job. I spent a lot of time as part of that inside the Treasury and the Ministry of Education and the Department of Business, because we were pushing. The aim of this big project with MIT was to improve the UK's economy in terms of productivity, entrepreneurship, and competitiveness. And I was inside the ministry, so I suddenly got interested in being a scientific advisor. And the long shot was I was a scientific advisor to a Department for Communities and Local Government, which is how the central government in the UK works with the 480 local authorities. And this was when the Climate Change Act was signed. And I, like everybody else, took the science at face value and started to look. The Department of Communities and Local Government saw itself as being mainly a social science department, focusing on community cohesion, bring up to date, you know, poor neighborhoods and all that sort of thing. But I pointed out to them that 45% of all the carbon dioxide emissions in the UK come from heating air and water in buildings. And this department had all the planning controls and all the building standard regulations. So I pointed out to the permanent secretary and the other sort of servants that this department had to be in the lead. And if we're going to take the next, in those days, it was an 80% reduction of carbon dioxide seriously. And I could get no traction because the people concerned just said, this is too much of a distraction. Leave that to the Department of Trade and Industry or the Department of the Environment. But I said, you are the ones who have all the levers to control standards, to enforce this to happen. I had real trouble. And it was only just as I was leaving that, just before I left, that Barack Obama was elected president. And he got up in his first address and said, I'm going to green every public building in the United States. And so that was heard over in England. Everyone was saying, oh, we've got to green all our buildings. And then they found out that that's exactly what I'd been pushing for. So I'm quite pleased to say that four departments of state did a major retrofit of their buildings. I told the government that because something like a third of all new buildings in the public sector, that this was a sector where the government couldn't just stop and tell the private sector what to do. It had to be fully in there, up to its knees, engaging in their own buildings before telling the private sector what to do. There were a number of things happened, but they've slowed down considerably. And the point I made, this was in 2008. I pointed out that from 1990 to 2005, there'd been a certain amount of progress improving the thermal envelope of buildings. But in order to reach the 2020 targets, which are long since passed, they had to go six times faster. And so this is the first time I saw these changes at scale. And I've not seen anything ramp up suddenly like that. I mean, in this country, it's really interesting. There was a rush about 5 or 10 years ago to put in solar and to put in wind farms. But when I come back now, I don't see lots and lots of new wind farms since I was last here. I don't think they're going in at anything like the same rate.
It's like it's a political thing, it's like a fad or a fashion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in your report, so what does, for New Zealand, what does net zero mean?
Well, this is a very complicated thing because there is something called absolute zero. I've got colleagues who say, well, let's see if we can design an economy that emits no carbon dioxide. And that means we have to stop flying and we have to stop most transport and so on. So that's not a standard. Net zero says that we're going to, excuse me, I'm going to have to charge my, plug my
of course,
computer in because it's running a bit low. Net zero means that we organize our economy such that we emit rather less carbon dioxide than we're doing now, but we also have technologies to take that carbon dioxide back out of the air so that the net result next year is there's no more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere next year than there is now because of human activity. And so that means you can still have a certain amount, but it's a very low amount, but you have to arrange to take it out. Now, I have been, in this particular achieving net zero, I've just taken some of the things we need to do, the high-level things. And the reason why I can be very confident that the cost will exceed, comfortably exceed $550 billion is that, for example, in doing those calculations, I took the two biggest problems that need to be tackled. On the one hand, we have to expand the electricity sector so that we have enough electricity to electrify ground transport. And we have to have enough electricity for both industrial and domestic heat. So the grid has to expand from 1 today to 1.7. The situation in England is different because we don't have lots of renewals and we have a much more extreme weathers from winter to summer. So that the grid there has to go from 1 to 2.7. And so that's one sector, one problem, that is to increase the electricity grid in terms of transmission, generation, transmission, and local distribution. You have to expand that. And at the same time, you have to go through all the buildings and improve the thermal efficiency so that we waste less heat. About 30% of the carbon emissions in this country also come from heating, air, and water and buildings.
Mm. So this electricity, we're looking at transport and heating.
Yeah.
And we're saying we're not going to burn coal, we're not going to use petrol, we're not going to use diesel, we're not going to use gas.
Yeah.
So we'll generate electricity and we have to increase our generation in the next, 25 years?
5 years,
By 70%.
Yeah.
So we're not allowed to, it's all the cheap dams presumably have been built.
Yes. I mean, it's important that all the large rivers, the capacity rivers, I mean, if you put a hydroelectric dam in a small creek on a farm, you mightn't get enough to, light the milk shed or something, but you won't get enough to power a suburb of Wellington.
It's not the Clyde Dam or the...
No. And so I think the... I'll tell you another thing which will surprise you. When you stand at a petrol station and you put the bowser into your petrol tank and there's petrol going into your car, the rate at which the energy is going in is 17 megawatts.
No.
Okay, 17 megawatts. So I'll show you why this is important. If you take Benmore, I think it is, which generates 340 megawatts. If you were to charge cars electrically as fast as you charge cars with petrol, the whole of Benmore would only be able to cope with 17 cars at a time. And they would like those 17 cars would only take 90 seconds, and then you put another. So it shows you, it's a way of comparing numbers that are striking. It was a friend of mine from Arizona State University pointed this 17 million out, and I've done the sums, and he's right.
Just walk me through that again and listen through that again. So you're putting in petrol in
when
your car.
When you put petrol into the car, you know that you're putting the capacity, the energy in that is going to drive your car for 500 kilometres and so on. But you're putting this energy in there for about 90 seconds. Okay. And when you actually calculate how much energy is the calorific and how much energy there is in that petrol when you burn it, as you burn it in the car, and you work out how much energy is in that car, and you divide it by 90 seconds, the rate at which the energy is going in is 17 megawatts, which is, if I've got it right, 17,000 1-bar heaters.
Yes.
See, this is one of the practical, but once you see that number, then it's lots of other things follow from it.
And a fast charger for a Tesla, which is the fastest chargers in New Zealand, at their maximum is 100 kilowatt hour in an hour.
Well, here's another problem, which is interesting, because it's one that was pointed out to me by a colleague in Scotland. Most houses in New Zealand have a 60 amp fuse. I'm told that some of the new buildings are even down at 35 amps. Now, when that standard was set probably 70 or 80 years ago, the largest electrical appliance in a home was either a kettle or an electric stove, drawing 7 or 13 amps. So you scale that up by a factor of 5 or so, and you say, well, you're not going to be using more than 5 appliances. But if we go to an all-electric home, then if you have, at the moment in this country, it's slightly different. You have an electric hot water system. In the UK, when I have a shower, the gas actually heats the water in real time. So I don't have a hot water tank in my house. I have a fast Califon. Yeah. Now, if you were to replace that gas Califon by an electric one, you actually need 28 or 30 amps of electricity. And if you have a radiator hob, you know, with those glowing elements on the top, and they're all glowing, it's drawing 28 amps. And if you have a fast charger, it's growing 32 amps. So you very quickly see in a household that every time people do anything, they're going to flip the switch because the 60 amps is going to be exceeded. And so we'll switch things off. So the current home, as we know, all of the current home needs to be rewired up to, first of all, the fuse has to go from about 60 amps to probably 150 or more. And a lot of the wires will need to be resized, taking because otherwise everything's going to get too hot and so on. And then furthermore, all along the street and all the local substations going to have to be upgraded. And you see, the cost for that in the UK alone is £700 billion. And I forgot the figure. It'll be in the paper I wrote of what the equivalent figure in New Zealand is. You could roughly divide it by 10, because it turns out when I've done these sums for different countries, although they're widely differing circumstances, the per capita costs are very much the same. So if we take 700 million, then it's 70 million or $140 million just to 70 billion, 140.
Just the relatively simple thing of rewiring your house and upgrading it is a huge cost. And you've got to do it to every house where there's a housing crisis here in New Zealand.
Well, I think the problem is very similar. I mean, if you look at, I take Wellington, which is where I study, you know, everybody knows about the problem of the water shortage. Well, the water and the water infrastructure needs serious upgrading. And yet there doesn't seem to be the money to do this on the scale required. This kind of upgrade for the distribution system to cope with an all-electric city, doing the things we're used to doing now in the future, is going to require sums on the same scale. And it's when you look at that and then say, well, who's going to pay, how are they going to pay, and actually the biggest problem of all is who's actually going to do the work.
Yes.
You know, who's actually going to do the work? I mean, we don't have, there's not enough unemployment here, and the people are not skilled to do it. I mean, I've suggested that in the case of the engineers, they're going to have to take them off health projects, defence projects, and all sorts of other things, which nobody was willing to do. So it just won't happen. It's as simple as that. It just won't happen.
And then we have the problem of distribution, like from the power station to Wellington.
Yeah, the transmission, yeah.
Yeah, transmission. Yeah. So that, transmission.
Yeah.
That needs a huge upgrade.
It's upgrade, yeah.
But I come back to, presumably, you're going to have to go nuclear.
Yes, yeah. But that's another issue for some time.
I can't see the New Zealand government saying, we've got to hit 2050.
Well, look, what's worrying me at the moment is a lot of the investment at the moment is going to have to be written off. That's what really worries. It's the reason I'm really upset about all this is the fact that there isn't a robust debate. If we had a robust debate, public debate on all these things, these things would have been out in the open years ago, and we may have thought of slightly different ways of doing things. But our media is hopelessly biased. I mean, I've had some dealings with the senior management of the BBC on this, because Mr. Sunak got up in Parliament last September and put back the date from 2030 to 2035 when all new cars have to be fully electric. And he said in Parliament, we seem to have got into a position where we have a consensus about the future that nobody's happy with. At no point has there been a serious cost-benefit analysis of what is proposed. Now, that's been my clarion call for the last decade. Where is the debate about who's going to do what to actually get there in the sense of having a technology roadmap that will actually get us there? And so what happened is I then wrote to Mr. Tim Davey, who's the head of the BBC, and I said, I hope you'll take a leaf out of Mr. Sunak's book and open a double-sided, fully open, clear debate. He wrote back to me and said, the BBC has been open and clear and wide-ranging ever since it started. So I wrote back and said, well, on the day that Mr. Sunak made a statement in Parliament, your website had six commentators, all of which were hostile to what Mr. Sunak had done. But I pointed out six other people from car companies and infrastructure companies and everybody else saying this was a very good idea because it would allow us to march at a steady and reasonable pace instead of a mad dash making lots of mistakes on the time. So I wrote back to him and said, well, here's a lot of evidence. So 6-0 hostile to Mr. Sunak doesn't seem to me like an honest and open debate. And also they pushed a wind farm, which has not gone well, and then they've dropped it. So I said, look, you've got plenty of evidence. And he actually wrote back and said, come on in. So the three of us went in to talk to the senior management. And trouble is, it was off the record, so I can't say anything public. But I think we taught them, a few hard truths. So I wait to see if anything gets any better.
I'm talking to physicist Professor Michael Kelly, and we're talking about the costs of getting to net zero in 2050 here in New Zealand, and the dire need before politicians open their mouths to be thinking about how it's going to be achieved, not in terms of we'll achieve X percent by this date, but actually the technology and the infrastructure that is needed. For example, we're going to have 70% more generating capacity. We're going to have a comparable increase in transmission from one end of the country to the other, and every house virtually will need to be seriously upgraded at enormous cost. The tricky thing, as Professor Kelly points out, is all very well saying you're going to do this. You might even have the money, the 500,000 million dollars.
Yeah.
But where are the people coming from?
And then the other problem,
the people that do this.
Yeah, well, the other problem is also we can't go and import them from India and China because they're supposed to be doing, this is a global problem, and they're supposed to be doing the same thing. You know, if we have, like in the UK, if you go in for a surgical operation, the people in the team are a veritable cross-section of the United Nations. They're from all over the place. But we can't go and import a whole lot of engineers, say, from India to help us, because they're supposed to be doing the same problem on roughly the same scale in India, a little bit smaller because they're not so advanced. But they've, to get to where they need all their engineers. So they have to be homegrown. And the last time I talked to a vice chancellor related to all this a few years ago, he said, well, the engineering departments have increased by 15%. They need to increase by a factor of 3 or 4 to actually produce the numbers. And of course, what they do when it's all finished, that's another matter as well. But so my personal view is that we're trying to undo what mainstream engineering has done since 1800.
Yes.
And you see all of the, funny enough, all the other technologies, whether it's solar, wind, nuclear, all of that was built on the back of coal and oil. You see, one of the things I ask the people, I haven't got an answer to my own satisfaction yet, is to say, when will we have enough, renewable energy such that we will make the next generation of renewable energy using renewable energy? That's a perfectly fair question.
I know, because you have to work out the congealed energy in an electric car. Tell me, the emissions trading scheme, which is the mechanism overall that New Zealand has chosen to deliver this net zero. So what happens is the cost of producing CO2 gets priced into everything you do. That's not going to cut it, reading your report, because the market itself in New Zealand, given the heavy hand of government, it cannot deliver the infrastructure just through pricing. I mean, the prices can go as high as you like. It's not going to magic up a nuclear power station.
No, I think the real problem, when you look at things at this scale, on that time scale, the only times that this has been achieved has been in war under a command economy.
Yeah.
And I think, see,
when and huge sacrifice. Huge sacrifice.
And so my point is, I referred to four problems that we have. One is the cost, the finances. One is the manpower. One is the materials. But the last one is the public buy-in. Nobody in New Zealand has bought into a lower standard of living much less freedom to do things. And 30 years of massive disruption while all this is going on around them at this enormous cost. So this is why none of this has happened. And in the case, what we've got now, particularly in Europe, is all the farmers are up in arms and the European Union has buckled. You know, the largest party in one of the houses of parliament in the Netherlands is now a farmers' party. And the Netherlands were busy saying we're going to have our agriculture. And
of course,
government said no.
Here in New Zealand, I assume the same is happening in the UK.
Yeah.
Our major news organisations are saying climate change is not to be debated. And by that, they also mean debating whether the target's a good idea or debating B, how on earth is this target going
I was upset. I won't mention the person, but I was on a cruise recently where a New Zealand scientist twice said, we don't debate the issue that it's all about carbon dioxide anymore. Now, I'm very upset about that because, you know, you could have said 100 years ago, or we don't debate Newton's laws anymore, and yet Einstein came along.
Just as a matter of
principle, there's no matter of science which is not for debate. The level of the debate and the tenor of the debate and so on is can vary completely. I mean, if I tried to say that I've come up with an alternative to Newton's laws, I'd have to come up with a very, very, very clear experiment which I can predict in advance will give me one answer if I'm right, one outcome if I'm right, and a different outcome if I'm wrong. And the big problem we used to have, I'd worked for 15 years in the same lab that Rutherford did his work in, and successive buildings as it happens. But we used to get lots of letters from people around the world thinking they'd discovered a new form of electricity or that sort of thing. And our standard response was, it's not for us, to go in and spend our time. We've got enough on our plate to undo what you've done and to try and tell you where you're wrong. It's up for you to come to us with a clear experiment which says, if I'm right, this is the outcome, and if I'm wrong, that's the outcome. Now let's do the experiment. We'll help you do the experiment just to see. But that's,
and of course, yeah. Einstein famously did that.
Yeah,
with the light.
And he also said it only needed one experiment to undermine everything he'd done.
Yes,
and so everything we've got is provisional. I've given up debating climate science with the climate scientists. After all, they are paid lots of money to work full-time on the problem. But there are a number of problems that still remain. I mean, I could give you a quote of a meeting that I was at the Royal Society where one of the leading scientists said, it must be carbon dioxide because we can't think of anything else it could be. Now, that is, I mean, I think that's it's a revealing statement. And it's actually, if you know where to look, it's on the Royal Society website. You can hear the verbatim quote. So
we've got all. It's the only variable that can explain the variation.
Yeah. But then you see, correlation is not causation, and that's one of the problems. And I suspect that the role of water is being underplayed as well. And you see, for every carbon dioxide molecule we produce in a chemical reaction, we normally produce two or three or four more molecules of water.
Mm.
And water is a very strong greenhouse gas. The only thing is it goes in and out of the atmosphere a lot. But if it suddenly became water rather than carbon dioxide as the bogey, you can imagine the problems you would suddenly have. You're not allowed to drink. You're only allowed to drink so much water a day. That would be crazy. So the analogies are quite crazy. But I'm not going there. I'm sticking. Over the last few years, I said I'm going to stick to engineering, which is my home territory.
Yes, and no, so when quite right.
The climate scientists have a go at me for interfering with them. So I keep saying, well, I mean, it was one time the previous president of the Royal Society in London, Paul Nurse, had a go at Nigel Lawson. And so he sent five fellows down to tell Nigel Lawson about climate science. And I happened to sit in the room at one end of the table. On neither side. I've joined Nigel Lawson's organizations as a trustee since. But it was interesting because they explained climate science and Nigel Lawson said, yes, I don't have any problem with that. And then they made one overclaim and he said, no, that claim was not right because of this, that. And so these people backed off. But then he turned to them and he said, well, look, the key word in our organization is policy. And policy is what do you do about it? So he said, I'll ask you five, what will you actually do? And they all shrank back saying, we're just the messenger. And to which he said, out of the room, this is a room for grown-ups to deal with. We're about doing things. So it's quite a lot of back history.
I'm trying to word this, Professor. I'm talking to Professor Michael Kelly. We're talking about the cost of achieving net zero. I don't understand so much about what happens in politics and why people articulate the things that they do because it doesn't make sense. And you'd ordinarily expect when someone's talking palpable nonsense to the tune that's going to cost us hundreds of billions of dollars to achieve some airy-fairy goal that doesn't mean anything to the person in the street, that they'd be sharply pulled up about it. They'd be pulled up about it, you'd think, by the civil service, by interest groups, by everyone, journalists. But we have quite intelligent politicians running around promising net zero without a clue of what that entails or how it's to be done. We have the media and experts discussing it as a target and whether it's an appropriate target or whether it be shorter, or whether it should be longer, or whether it should be tougher. Invariably, the answer is it should be tougher, as you explained with Mr. Rishi Sunak. Why is there no discussion about the how? How could that be? Like, if I was going to say, oh, I'm going to get everyone going across the harbour in their cars. And they say, well, that mean a bridge. Yeah. Don't worry about the bridge. They're not explaining the bridge or getting across the water. Or how the bridge is to be built, or how the bridge is to be financed. This is the thing. This is what fossil fuels have done, is made the modern world. We're going to radically constrain them, so we only produce as much carbon dioxide as we elsewhere consume. And yet we're to do this and have a more prosperous economy. How do you explain the complete ignorance on behalf of the public debate?
Well, I think it's part of a bigger issue. It's completely tied up with the woke agenda and various other agendas. You know, the Vice Chancellor of Cambridge recently wasn't extended, as might have done, because he was sponsoring a system of coping with microaggression, so that if I, as a lecturer, said something that offended somebody in the class, even about engineering, if I used an example from somewhere and he lived next door and felt it didn't cope well with the, you know, if I showed him an example of a failed bridge and he lived at one end of the bridge, then he could go and complain that I was upsetting him. So, you know, everything is, and universities now have safe rooms where you can go in and not be challenged. I mean, when I left home, I was told that the purpose of going to university was to be challenged to think and to be ready to be challenged.
And to be knocked around by your professors for stupidity.
To be told, you know, you're, anyway, so there is a widespread, it's not just climate change. Climate change is one of the things that's got under the agenda. So there aren't public debates on these issues. I've tried for 10 years at the Royal Society to have a debate. And my most recent example is we have something called Net Zero Watch, which produces a weekly samizdat, just a list of things. So I sent a copy of one, the headlines of one, to the president of the Royal Society and the Royal Academy of Engineering. This was a set of 10 clippings one day, where the first five were different car companies describing the problem they were having and selling their cars. The next three were three turbine companies explaining the fact that they were pulling out of wind turbine contracts they'd already signed because they were going to lose money on it, and a couple of others about material shortages or some of the things. And I sent this off to the president of the Royal Society and said, we should have a two-day discussion meeting about this. So I prepared the bid and said, look, everybody is talking about net zero, so it's possible. I want to set up a meeting to produce a red team report. That is all the problems with net zero. Anyway, it was turned down because they said I wasn't having a two-sided debate. My whole premise had been, for the last 10 years, there'd been a one-sided debate, and I wanted to get the other side together. And so, and I produced five books, and they said they weren't peer-reviewed. So this is not, these were all books that are published have a form of peer review. So the whole thing is totally, totally hypocritical. 10 years ago, a group of us tried to have a meeting on the downsides of decarbonizing an economy. And so we put the bid in. We were asked to, at the annual general meeting, we asked to put in a bid. 3 years later, we never got a yes and we never got a no. We're thinking about this or that. In the end, it was taken off us and given to somebody else, and it turned into a meeting of technologies to decarbonize an economy, exactly 180 degrees from what we'd intended. So there's no willing. My point is, there's enough evidence to say that there is not enough of open, honest, two-sided debate of the sort of thing that characterized science as I learnt it in the 60s and 70s and practiced in the 70s and 80s and onwards.
It's the antithesis of science.
Absolutely.
It must be heartbreaking.
I have tried to debate this paper of mine in many fora, but not a single person wants to stand up and debate me. And I keep saying, look, if I put a paper out there and it's wrong, and you can show me it's wrong, the world would be on a better off place. They would know something that I don't know at the moment, or others do. So I just want the debate. But most people think they'll be knocked off their pedestal. I'm pretty confident they would be knocked off their pedestal rather than me.
Well, they haven't allowed their arguments or understanding to be strengthened, which is what debate does.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, that you could be right and someone's arguing with you, and you see a better side to your understanding. I mean, that's the purpose of open debate.
Okay.
But how on earth in the Western world, for a huge policy that's the size of the health sector in New Zealand, magicking up another one, that size of commitment, I still come back to it, Professor Kelly.
Mm.
How on earth can the legions of people that you'd ordinarily expect to be debating this and discussing this in a respectful and human, rational, enlightened way, what has happened? Where is that? Because we're talking the Royal Society.
Yeah.
I mean, the Royal Society of all places.
Well, I was a fellow of the Royal Society of New Zealand, but I resigned about 6 or 7 years ago on this very issue. They produced a report called Transitioning New Zealand to a Low Carbon Economy. And it was of such a low standard in terms of engineering quality that I wrote in and said that, you know, if this was came out of an engineering consultancy, either the CEO would be sacked for sanctioning it or the people concerned should have been chastised. It had no hard numbers. And I contacted the person involved, and he said there were no hard numbers. I came home on a sabbatical and spent 4 months getting the hard numbers. And when I wrote it up, out of their 45 original recommendations, 3 made sense. 7 made no difference to the actual carbon emissions. They were matters of labeling things so that people could be informed when they made choices. And the other 33 or so were either ruinous or ineffective. And
unbelievable.
So I wrote it, and they said, we've spoken and we're not going to speak again. So I wrote it as a scientific paper, and it was sent to somebody who I know was, first of all, to referee, who was the author of this previous report because of a couple of remarks made. And then it was sent, I protested at that. Then it was sent to Australia, and they got 3 referees, all engineers, who wrote back something remarkably similar, all saying it was a very important piece of work, but we couldn't possibly agree with the conclusions. But they didn't say how they could disagree. And so it was never published. And I wrote to the Royal Society and said, appealed to the council to give some time for scientific integrity, and they said no, so I resigned.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Good for you. What we have here is something that we've seen in Soviet Russia, something that we've seen, God, I hesitate to use this example, but in the rise of Nazi Germany.
I don't tend not to go there because that's...
No. Professor Kelly.
Yeah, yeah.
It is this it's a feature of a totalitarian system that ideology trumps science. That the politics, the getting the political conclusion correct, agreeing with the system and the government is more important than getting to the truth. And what those responses when they say they can't agree with your conclusions, they're saying the ideology to which we've signed up to trumps the science. Isn't that correct?
Well, I've never had it put that way, but that's quite insightful, and I'll take it away and think about it. Because that's what it amounts to. I mean, I don't mind them saying we can't agree with your conclusions for following 5 reasons because we think they're wrong. They didn't challenge. The point is that when I do give this talk, I tell people, you can challenge me on my data, you can challenge me on my assumptions, and you can challenge me on my logic.
Yes.
Now, which of those 3 do you want to take apart? Yes. And, you know, I'd get no take-up. I was interesting recently. I gave a talk to the one of the student societies in Cambridge about this very topic, and I was heard with respectful silence and then asked penetrating questions. I have a bit of hope in the next some of the people in the next generation.
Yes, and of course, do you think it'll change when the cost of these policies start to bite?
Yes.
And this is the public acceptance, which is a very interesting part of your report, because, again, this is excluded from the debate, other than people saying, oh, yeah, no, net zero, yeah, oh, no, we've got to do something, yes, no. But it's not put to them, this is what it will mean for your household budget and your lifestyle.
One friend of mine in England, in the House of Lords, a man called Peter Lilly, who was in Mrs. Thatcher's cabinet, when the famous Climate Change Act of 2008 was signed into law, debated and passed into law, there were only six people voted against it, and he, Peter, was one, because his first degree was in physics in Cambridge, and then he moved to economics. And he went to the library of the House of Parliament and said, can I see all the background papers and the cost-benefit analysis and that sort of thing? And he said, well, there's not very much here, and there's certainly not a cost-benefit analysis. But he was told that he was the sole MP who'd come to the library to ask for background information on this major issue before it was voted through. It's quite clear that the vast majority of MPs did not know what they were voting for.
No.
And then Mrs. May took it forward to net zero. And again, no substantive debate. I think there was half an hour. It was rushed through Parliament without any substantial debate on the engineering feasibility. I'll tell you what the real problem is. There's been no serious engineering analysis.
Mm.
And you'll find very few engineers will stand up in public and say, let's go for this, other than the fact they're running a business where you follow the money. I was sitting on a train once going from London to Cambridge, arguing this discussion with a friend. And somebody who's got off the train said, I wish you'd shut up. You're the sort of person who is ruining my business. And he said, what do you do? He said, I make windmills.
Well, I got a friend who makes a lot of money because he has trees that suck up carbon dioxide. And it's sort of it disgusts me get paid to grow a tree because it sucks up carbon dioxide. You're thinking, and of course,
can I just also, while I think about it, recommend a short film that's with the Net Zero Watch. It's by a man called John Constable, the same name as the famous painter, but it's basically a summary of the energy transition and points out that in a piece of coal, all the energy is concentrated, but in the wind and in solar, the energy is dispersed. And the key thing about a combustion engine, it takes that condensed energy and does work. And in the end, that energy is conserved, but it's dissipated into heat from the engine block that goes out, friction against the car as the car's moving it. And so at the end of the day, you've burnt the petrol. But in the case of the wind and the case of the solar, the fraction of the energy that you get out of it that you use to get it out in the first place is actually quite high. And there's a well-designed thing that says that the advanced economies in the world run on an energy return on energy invested for the fuel of about 15.
Mm.
And that's because coal runs at about 30 and nuclear at about 70. But wind and solar, they are about 15. But when you put on to the fact that solar should be responsible for providing the energy when solar is not available, i.e. at night, or wind farms should be responsible for providing the energy when the wind isn't blowing. When you add that on as a cost, then the return on investment is about 7 or 8. And so it would allow us to have a basic society, but not one with advanced medicine, higher education, or advanced transport. If you look at the world before fossil fuels, it's the 1700s. And you go back there for all of the human development, intense human development, has come in the last 200 years. Mm. And we're trying to undo it in terms of 90-something percent of all the energy we've used since 1800 in civilization has been fossil fuels. And we're trying to undo it in 30 years. It's just not going to happen.
It's not going to happen, and they don't seem to care.
Well, that's Anyway, look, I leave it at that.
Yes. Now, we'll wrap this up. Professor Kelly, thank you for your work. If you want to see Professor Kelly's wonderful report, and I have to say, we have only just touched on it. There is so much in here, and the implications are huge. It's almost a modest report with these explosive implications. You'll find this report on the Global Warming Policy Foundation, and the report is called Net Zero for New Zealand, a report from a, I can't say this word,
putative delivery
agency by Professor Michael Kelly. It's a must read. I want to go back to the startling fact and see if I've got this right, because I'll get into a debate and I'll have the numbers wrong, that if you take how much energy is going into your car when you fill it at the gas station, it takes 90 seconds. And then you look at Benmore. It was Benmore, I think you said.
Yes.
You look at Benmore, there on the Waitaki River, pouring out power. It would do 17 cars at a time, 90 seconds each. 17 cars. Think how many cars are filling up with gas in any one moment in New Zealand, and think about how many Benmores you need. Oh my goodness!
And can I just finish off with one analogy that people might find helpful, and that there's nothing new in the world in terms of human folly. What's going on now has a very strong parallel with the Tower of Babel. In the Old Testament, people wanted to build a tower to heaven. There were two things about that project. That, first of all, they didn't know where heaven was, so they didn't know in advance how they would be able to declare they succeeded. So nobody has said what the nature of climate change will be when it stopped. Will it be stationary? Will it be static? The climate will carry on changing whatever we do, as it has throughout geological history. And the second thing, they had no idea how much it would cost. And so we're just repeating the folly of the Tower of Babel all over again.
That's a wonderful analogy. Thank you for that. I'm talking with Professor Michael Kelly. Great report. Amazing physicist. Wonderful that he's spending his time to elucidate for us, the citizens who are going to be paying for this, what net zero is all about. You're on Reality Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Send me a text 2057. Email me inbox@radleycheck.radio.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.